Living.
That's good.
Yeah.
How about Michael? complaints?
Complaints. Grievances.
Grievances? Yeah. I don't have any grievances right now. I'm
work.
Well, I mean, I'm looking for work, but you know, other than that, you know.
To all our listeners,
find Doctor History Sage Scholar a job.
Send us in the comments links to potential positions that a Doctor History Moral Scholar might like.
Yeah.
You know, like. I'm at a loss actually.
What's it? The Library of Alexandria?
Perhaps. Oh yes, if you have a job at the Library of Alexandria, that's a good one. Oh, and also because I know he's a big listener, Ken Burns. Come on, Ken.
Kenny,
Burns.
Come Get on, a. Kenny.
Burnsy, Burnsy boy. KB, where are you at?
KB.
I haven't seen you since
Gazz it up, man, in this podcast.
Yo, KP, I haven't seen you since that time we smoked salvia in college. Shut up. I'm important documentarian.
Start playing a Ashokan Farewell in the background. That's the song that's always playing in the Civil War documentary.
Right.
I just remember Vine.
I feel like that's like every one of his documentaries. He does like that.
Except jazz.
Banjo.
That one had good music.
Like baseball sounded the same.
I watched the first episode of the Prohibition one, and it had, I think, my favorite quote, my two favorite quotes about Prohibition come out of that. Which is that apparently the Methodists said that Lutherans drank in public and prayed in private, and the Lutherans responded, "Yeah, well, the Methodists pray in public and drink in private."
Yes. And then that makes sense.
And then a traveling British businessman goes, "The Americans drink constantly. They drink to open a deal. They drink to close a deal. They drink at baptisms, weddings, funerals. They drink at the beginning of the day. They drink at the end of the day. They drink with every meal. They drink before the meal, after the meal." It's this quote that keeps going on how much we drank in the 1890s.
British are judging us for their drinking habits.
Yeah. Like literally every single factor you have runs on fucking gin. Whatever. At the time, especially like, well, when I lost my end, it wasn't so bad because I was drinking a gin at the time. Might have had to do with the accident there at the factory, but also because, you know, the landlords don't give a fuck about us. All right. Anyway, but
you've been working on your Cockney accent.
Thank you. Yeah, I am. I was in the bog working on it, right?
You're listening to Laughing Historically with Adam Lax, Adam Cooney, and Dr. History Scholar.
Welcome to Laughing Historically. I'm your host, Adam Lax. And on the ones and twos, we got Adam Cooney.
Pew, 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 pew.
And we got Dr. History Sage Scholar, Moral Emperor of the Universe.
Mm-hmm. Emperor?
Well, Emperor of the Galaxy.
Of the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Ever since he started shooting lightning out of his fingers.
There were 65 orders, and then that last one was a doozy.
Actually, last time we recorded, I was like, "Should I have another beer?" And he looked at me and goes, "Do it.
Let the beer flow through you."
I will.
He's like, "To better judge you with."
Your friends are out there dying. I'm gonna forget a lot of those lines.
All right, and we got this day in history.
Yeah, so today is August 4th, mm-hmm. and the first of these, I've got three. I think I'll leave them to each part, so we've got one for each part. But the first one is in 1790.
This is a multiple-part episode?
Probably.
Okay.
You know, we'll see.
All right.
So in 1790, the Congress passed a tariff act to pay off Revolutionary War debts, and this called into being the United States Revenue Cutter Service, the precursor of the Coast Guard. As a law enforcement agency to crack down on smuggling.
Revenue Cutter Service.
Yeah, so a cutter is a type of boat, mm-hmm. right? So it's so the Revenue Cutter Service as a law enforcement agency to crack down on smuggling so that people would actually pay the tariff. And it will be housed in the Treasury Department, as the United States did not have a Navy in 1790, just at all. And thus was...
John Paul Jones didn't leave a legacy of a...
At least not yet. And thus it's under the control of Alexander Hamilton, Right, so Hamilton creates essentially the Coast Guard.
I'm actually, I saw a play recently where he apparently invented hip hop too.
Yeah. I was found out. He got that tariff through a rap battle with Thomas Jefferson. Yeah.
I wish any of us were like not so white. So freestyle a Hamilton rap battle. No, it's not happening. I'm sorry. We can't.
Our first guest will be a rap battle.
No. Do you know any?
I don't know.
Nope,
I know
black me neither. Dr. History Scholar, you know any rap battlers?
Nope.
Not the... Nah, I think we're kind of... You know, listeners?
Will, Paul,
Zach.
Zach.
If you know any rap battlers, send them our way. They have to like history, so...
All white dudes, do you know any rap battlers?
Okay.
There's one guy in our audience who's like, all my favorite rappers are white. Oh, shit. Son of a bitch.
Were you homeschooled?
Macklemore's the greatest voice of a generation. So it's funny because actually the Coast Guard's Homeland Security now, but I think they basically do the same thing.
Yeah, they're doing. Yeah, yeah.
Coast Guard's Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I thought they were a branch of the military.
They are, but they are funded through Homeland Security.
It's almost as if the Department of Homeland Security is dumb because I don't know. We have like a Department of Defense. Central Intelligence Agency. And a Federal Bureau of Investigation. I don't know. I can keep going.
The National Security Agency.
Yeah, we seem to be...
Military Industrial Complex.
Well, that's not an official part of government. I'm not sure about
that. We've got the cult of Moloch. I mean, we've got...
We privatized the Military Industrial Complex.
This is why it makes sense. It's much like an abusive coach on a Little League team. It's that all of these agencies are like Little League players, and we're getting them to compete against each other,
right,
so that one of them really hits it out of the park.
Okay,
and doesn't approval. You know, so let a weird fringe group blow up our towers with planes, like, you know, what I mean? Something like that.
Okay,
Daddy Congress can approve of you.
Congress is a daddy.
Is definitely.
Actually, 50% of the people in Congress get called daddy, but they pay for it. So they have to spend money to get called daddy. Thank you, Lex. Dr. Moral Scholar didn't like that at all. Seemed like he thought it was, I don't know, tearing at the fabric of his democracy.
He's like, and I shall strike you down.
All right. So shall we begin?
Yeah. All right.
So we are doing Theodore Roosevelt's Crowded Hour.
Oh. Crowded Hour!
I was just thinking about Teddy, man.
Yeah. So
really?
Well, I listened to the episode recently. Oh,
finally. It was like a couple months ago.
Yeah. I just listened to it yesterday. It was great.
So when we last checked in with Theodore Roosevelt, back in episode 10, if you want to go back and
fact
listen
check.
To him.
All right.
He had just resigned from the New York City Police Board and was on his way to become Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
With a cape. Right.
With the cape.
With the cape crusader.
Oh, my God. Adam's going to have all the references this time because he just listened to the episode. I'll be like, oh, yeah, shit. We did talk about that. All right.
And so he's...
Oh, wasn't there a whore mountain?
No.
I think that's a different one.
You're thinking... Shit. That's in Boston. Mount Hordem.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking about Mount Hordem. Yeah. It'll pop into your head every
He had the exploratory club or whatever. The Booty and Crockett.
The Booty and Crockett Club. I remember that. Is he still in the Booty and Crockett Club? Ooh, is he president of the Booty and Crockett Club?
So he's on his way to become Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the McKinley administration. Today we will discuss Roosevelt's, quote, crowded hour, the 18 months from April 1897 to November 1898. So this is the shortest period of time I think we'll ever talk about with Roosevelt. We're talking about 18 months.
Wow. Okay.
In these months, more than any other portion of his life, would catapult him to the heights of power.
Who calls it the crowded hour?
He calls it. It's a reference to it will be fully explained in the episode, okay. But he references a moment in his life as his crowded hour.
This is a good
phrase. He was a lot like Churchill too, where he did a lot of like biographing himself.
Self-hagiography or whatever. He did a lot of we'll talk about that too.
Nice.
That comes up. But he is very, he writes multiple autobiographies during his life. So he was, however, in 1897, someone depressed about his fellow countrymen. Right. In 1897, he's a little depressed.
So he's in good company, I suppose.
He felt them to be, on the whole, too materialistic and commercial to be great.
America?
Yeah, America was too materialistic and too commercial to be truly great.
Things have changed so much.
He's being jingoistic for the time, too. He's basically being... We call it jingoism in our history because we don't like the way nationalism feels. Yeah. Like, we're like, I don't want to wear that coat of nationalism. Yeah. I feel like some European countries have put coat on and been real shitty about it. So we'll call it... He's a jingo. He's not a... You know, he's basically being like... Not necessarily an ethno-nationalist, if I understand his kind of personal politics. Like, he was like a progressive for race at the time, and he's like, what we gotta do is have all the races fight a big fucking war. And whoever wins, you're the best. You're the best race.
So. You win the crown of master race.
Yeah, right.
So he was worried that Americans were more worried about the next dollar than doing the right thing, right? Where would the next dollar come from than doing the right thing? They were, quote, barbarians of a certain kind with a certain middle-class Philistine quality of ugliness and pettiness. The commercial and cheap altruistic spirit, the spirit of the banker, the broker, the mere manufacturer, and the mere merchant is unpleasantly prominent, end quote. That's what he's saying about other Americans. They're all bankers and brokers.
Anti-capitalist, kind of.
No, it's fucking like Romanesque elitism. Yeah. Like a true gentleman is above money.
Yeah. And it is the kind of thing.
He already had the money. Exactly. So he didn't have to go out and fucking earn it.
That's true. It's the noblesse oblige of having generational wealth.
Leisurely.
Having to worry about things like counting one's money is for the people who are poorer than I am.
Yeah, instead of weighing it.
My family hasn't had to count their money since 1066 when we helped conquer Britain. They all did that shit.
So there were exceptions to this, of course.
1066 was like the British Isles' Woodstock for generation family. Like every family was like, we were there. We were fucking totally at 1066. We partied, man. We partied hard.
There were exceptions to Roosevelt's view of his fellow Americans. Soldiers and sailors, engineers who constructed the infrastructure of the growing continental empire, the police who maintained law and order, industrial laborers who actually produced consumer goods, and farmers who actually grew food. Right. So these are the people, in his mind, are like going out and doing something, right? There is a tangible...
He liked the dudes working with their hands.
Well, yeah.
No, there is an American mix of like the honor of like working with your hands. And I mean, he went out west or whatever. Yeah. He knew a lot of those kind of guys. Yeah. Oh, and Maine.
Yeah.
He went
out west. The Maine west lumberjacks.
He was like, listen, lumberjacks, you know, you're used to Maine. We're going out west.
Where there is no trees. Yeah. They are lumberjacks. No trees.
We're taking you way out of your league.
Definitely pay you. I will definitely be paying you. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the first Western bar they went into too? Where it was just like 18 guys who were 17 feet fucking tall and, you know, 1850 or whatever. Whatever it was. What year was it?
1880s.
1880, yeah.
So he would say of these, quote, I cannot see that we have lost vigor. If anything, we've gained it. In political matters, we are very dull mentally and especially morally. But even in political matters, there's plenty of rude strength. And I don't think we are as badly off as we were in the days of Jefferson. For instance, we are certainly better off than we were in the days of Buchanan, end quote.
He's writing this in a letter
to a friend of his. And he's saying, you know, like, we don't do the right thing politically, but like the material is there. The spirit is there. It just needs something to, you know, coalesce around, right? Unlike the days of his least favorite president probably would be James Buchanan as well, right? You know, like, you know, fuck that guy.
Yeah, fuck.
Well, and I mean, he was used to fighting Tammany Hall bullshit, exactly, right? Like, that was his whole, especially if you were a Republican at that time, it was like entrenching Tammany Hall Democrats from New York was a real fucking Serpico fucking thing.
Yeah.
That's why he had the cape.
So
they cannot see me. Did he have little beads that he would throw at the ground and smoke would explode?
He didn't have to. There was no street lights. That's why he's wearing the cape. It hides him in the dark. So part one, the hot weather secretary.
So, I'm going to make a video game called Assassin's Creed Roosevelt.
Do you know how much Teddy Roosevelt would have loved that?
He would have loved it.
Oh, he'd have loved it so much. He'd been like, this is amazing.
I mean, said, Teddy, goddamn, you're good at those counterattacks. Just press B. Just press B a few times. If you do it at the right moment, you stab them through their neck. I love this game. It's almost like I have ADHD, and I'm going to hyper-focus on it for about the next 15 years. In our country. I actually listened to a bunch of Teddy Roosevelt. Was that okay?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Our average listener is going to have no fucking idea what Teddy Roosevelt sounded like. But
I would assume that was what he said.
Yeah, he has a very he has a kind of high-pitched kind of transatlantic.
Mid-Atlantic,
mid-Atlantic sort of upper-class accent.
Yeah.
So with William McKinley's election to the presidency, there were jobs galore for prominent Republicans. And Henry Cabot Lodge, the senator from Massachusetts, lobbied hard for the president to appoint T.R. as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. So on April 19, 1897, Roosevelt was sworn into that role. And once in office, as Ada Donald put it in her book, The Lion in the White House, quote, once more he gobbled up myriad details of his job, often breaking old boundaries, end quote. So he just immediately goes right into it.
By breaking old boundaries, do you mean like learning things that are like above his pay grade, or like
doing things that are above his pay grade?
Oh, nice.
And doing more than any previous assistant secretary. So at the
much
time,
more aggressive,
much more aggressive, because Roosevelt only had one speed: aggressive. He didn't do anything not aggressively.
He's one of those people. It's like I look up to him as like a person, maybe, but I would not want to work for or with that guy. Just like God, dude.
He's definitely for sure.
I think we said this in the last episode, but he was definitely the kid in class who'd be like, "You forgot to assign his homework."
Yeah.
Probably. So a photograph of him at the time shows a thin man with close cropped hair, a well-trimmed mustache, and eyes scrunched up to hold his pince-nez in place. So his glasses, right there, attached to the string, chain. So they have to be. Yeah. He has to always be kind of squinty to hold them in place.
Why wouldn't they just put the bars on him?
So it's a fashion thing, and also I don't think he needed them. He only needed them to like read, so you could take
so it's
it.
Easier, yeah. I see. And they're attached to a gold chain. That you could be like jingle, 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 baby, look at my gold chain.
He's seated in a leather padded chair, legs crossed, with a book in his lap, and his hand is curled into their customary fist. So he's any picture you see of Roosevelt, his
he's always got a fist
because he it's to make himself sit still. It's that ADHD thing. Like someone was like, he is not angry. He is just like, if I don't curl my hands into fists, I am going to just be twitching constantly.
Wasn't he the one who would like stand up while reading?
Yeah,
like
he was. Yeah, that when he was a kid, and on one leg.
On one leg.
Yeah,
who invented the standing desk. That son of a bitch.
So behind him is a model of one of the new battleships that the Navy acquired, and he appears to be doing what he loved most: holding court. So this photograph of him looks—he looks like he is talking to somebody while reading a book behind a battleship, right? Like Roosevelt is in his element in this in this particular photo.
It was basically that generation's version of a dungeon master. Like, Adam doesn't know what we're talking about. Yeah, no.
He's photogenic.
He'd be a really good one, I think.
Oh, he'd be a great dungeon master. He'd do all the voices too.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But nah, I'm a goblin.
But they'd all be the same voice.
I'm an ogre.
I really.
No, I'm a giant.
I'm a lich.
What the... Teddy, you could stop if you want. I mean, we're having fun.
No, it'd be for me more than you.
So he would hold the job of Assistant Secretary of the Navy for only 1 year. He's only in that position for 1 year. And in that year, he would ensure that the Navy, not the Army, was the stronger and more important branch of the armed forces. He had spent his whole life fascinated with sea power, and he was swept along by concepts of jingoism and imperialism. He would build a strong Navy. He was aided in this quest by perhaps the most influential naval theorist in modern history, Alfred Thayer Mahan.
I've heard about him.
Yeah, right. I had to read one of his books in school.
Oh, actually, really?
Yeah. The influence.
He's American?
Yeah, he's an American. He was taught at the Naval Academy.
Oh.
What was the book called?
When was he?
The Influences of Sea Power Upon History is the name.
He was alive at that same time.
Yeah, he was a little bit older than Roosevelt.
Okay.
Like he'd served in the Civil War as a young officer, okay. Whereas Roosevelt was a toddler in the Civil War. So he's like 15, 20 years older than Roosevelt. Mm. But since Roosevelt is Assistant Secretary of the Navy and Mahan works at the Naval Academy, they become friends and they agree on everything.
He was like a faculty member?
Yeah, yeah. And eventually, I think, ran the academy.
This is kind of interesting, too, mm-hmm. to think about. And I can cut this aside, but I want to mm-hmm. do this aside with you because it's just like an mm-hmm. interesting idea, right? Like, I'm going to take like the guns, germs, and steel sort mm-hmm. of look at history that you essentially had like four spots of major mm-hmm. civilization, right? You yep. had the Americas, which were doing their own thing
yep.
for until most Columbus. Of human history. Yeah, yeah. And essentially, you just don't, you see huge empires, you see tons of like military strength, mm-hmm. literacy, all that stuff. You just don't really see naval power mm-hmm. to a large mm-hmm. degree, mostly because, like, why? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that it's interesting because you kind of really do also see that in China and the Middle East, which yeah. are the other two major like power centers yeah. In human history. Really the only one you see naval power being a big part of like multiple stories throughout history. And I might be wrong, right? Like if you are a listener and you're from India and you're like, fuck you, I know about 25 naval battles or whatever, I might be wrong. Mm-hmm. But I read this book a few years ago. I think it was called like The Mediterranean, mm-hmm. History yeah. of Europe on the Water.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've heard of that.
Yeah, one. And it was really good. I was like surprised how good yeah, it was. Yeah. And one of the things they make the argument about is there aren't that many places in the world that essentially have a big circular highway mm-hmm. running through them everywhere. Like, so it's like Greece was attached to Rome, was attached to, you know, the Middle East, was attached to Egypt, mm-hmm. was attached to North Africa, because you would just get on a ship and go there.
Right.
And most parts of the world don't have that dynamic. Yeah. And it's interesting that like a Westerner from America still coming from that sort of European, mm-hmm. like I don't think someone would have written that kind of book in those other three cultures because mm-hmm. it just wasn't mm-hmm. like maritime. And again, I might be wrong, but you just didn't have this history. There was no, the sister battle to Thermopylae in ancient Greece?
Salamis.
Yeah. There is no Salamis. There is no, you know,
Lepanto or
what's the battle of Brutus against
Actium.
Like, I mean, like literally, you could probably name 12 to 24 naval battles in Western history,
yeah.
And I think even like, and again, might be wrong, but like. It would be much harder if, say, you were a Chinese historian to name a bunch of that many naval battles that matter.
So this is there. You know, I just one thing, and then we'll continue on. But I think you have what you're talking around. I think is the concept that, you know, if you turn a map of Eurasia on its side, right, so that Europe is at the top of this map and mm-hmm. Vladivostok is at the bottom of the map. What you see is that Europe is a peninsula.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so all of the states of Europe.
It's like peninsulas on a peninsula.
Yeah, yeah, but, yeah, but the point being that almost every European state is a maritime state, right?
Yeah, to some degree.
They have, and they have multiple coastlines. Some of them are very long, right? Like, for instance, the British are an island, but when you're the French, you have two very long stretches of coastline yeah. that are not connected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is a strategic problem. When you're Spain, and especially after the British take Gibraltar, you have the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
You have these separate pieces of coastline that have potentially enemy states in the between.
Yeah.
If you were Italy or Greece, not only are you peninsulas, but you're peninsulas that are, after 1492, pinned in into the Mediterranean when the rest of the world is going out into the
yeah.
Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're Sweden or Norway, or even Russia, you know, you need access to the water, right?
Right, but you only get it
6 months out of
three,
the year.
Three months out of the year, depending upon, yeah.
And so the point being that whereas, you know, when you're China, you can look to the sea, you can look to the ocean, or you could look to this massive
yeah.
land mass in the interior, right?
Most of your threats are coming from
exactly,
that
yeah.
land.
Yeah. Because there are
land threats.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, you know, the question, you know, someone, one military historian said, you could summarize World War II by Germany as a land power who picked a fight with naval powers, right? Like, they picked a fight with Britain.
World War II?
Yeah, and he's like, it's a land... I mean, you have the Soviet Union, but when the war starts, right? In 1939, when Germany invades Poland, it goes to war... As a land power with the world's premier naval power,
and they got beat at the navy, and they're like, ah, fuck that, we'll go for the other land power. And that land power's like, we're going to see about that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But I will crush you.
Or even World War One. I mean, the German.
Do we have enough blood in Soviet Union to literally drown them? Like, we drain all our soldiers' blood, and then we let them go. Germans drowned. We win war.
It's what we're really good at. Throw all our people at you.
So Mahan is the naval intellectual. He, with his high forehead, action accentuated by being bald and having close-cropped white beard, and his eyes nearly hidden under big bushy eyebrows.
So are you also confused as why those things make you good at Navy?
No.
I'm incredible.
Do that line for him. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to bust your balls on the right.
So the naval intellectual, right? He's an intellectual with his high forehead.
No. Before that, go one line, one sentence before that.
Aided in most influential naval theorist in modern history, Alfred Thayer Mahan. And now I'm describing what he looked like.
No. I feel like you're skipping over the line right now.
Which one? The bushy eyebrows? That's the line after.
But right before that, you said he. Didn't you say like he was a good naval officer because of his
naval
big
intellectual
forehead?
I said intellectual.
Say it again.
Okay, the naval intellectual with his high forehead, accentuated by being bald, having a close-cropped white beard and eyes nearly hidden under bushy eyebrows. He was born on September 27th, 1840, at West Point. He's the son of one of that academy's professors. So his dad was a professor. Was a professor at West Point. And a man who taught most of the Civil War's generals, right? His dad taught like Grant and Sherman and Lee and Jackson. Nice. Alfred entered the Naval Academy.
Quite a final exam.
Yeah. Alfred entered the Naval Academy and graduated in time for the Civil War. And during that conflict, he commanded several ships, none of them well. He was not a good sailor. Mm. He's a good thinker, not a good sailor. He ran at least one ship aground, which in the Navy is normally grounds to have someone let go if you crash the ship.
Well, the big thing with being the captain of a ship is keeping it in the water.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's like your first job is to like make sure it's floating the whole time. Yeah. Wait, could I ever have it not floating? No. Only in very special circumstances can it not be floating. Let's just keep it floating.
It was not his skills as a sailor, but his skills as an academic that would make him so important. So he writes two books, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, 1660 to 1783, which I had to read large portions of, and The Influence of Sea Power Upon the French Revolution and Empire, 1793 to 1812, so basically the sequel. In these works, he argued that for a large modern navy...
Was the sequel better than the original?
I haven't read the sequel, so I don't know. It's the same.
It's Godfather 2. It's very naval.
It's
I will say, if it's French Revolution era, it's going to be like, you want naval power to move that fucking sugar? Because that shit is valuable. Probably don't give up your colony. Probably keep it. I don't know. You know.
It's variations on the same theme. He's got an axe to grind. He's using history to prove his point.
Right.
So he argues for a large modern navy and attempted to show that naval power is more important than land power. That is the gist of both of those books, is to say that the country with the stronger navy tends to be the one that wins.
Well, that's true.
Roosevelt was taken in by these ideas, and they gave academic form to concepts that he had been thinking about and espousing since he wrote his book, The Naval War of 1812.
Right.
And so the two of them become fast friends, and 1 month into being at the Navy Department, Roosevelt laid out his ideas, his views to Mahan in a letter. Quote, "As regards Hawaii, if I had my way, we would annex those islands tomorrow. If that is impossible..."
Which islands?
Hawaii.
Hmm.
"If that was impossible, I would establish a protectorate over them. I believe that we should build a Nicaraguan canal at once, and in the meantime, build a dozen new battleships. I am fully alive to the danger from Japan. We should acquire the Virgin Islands, and by turning Spain out, should serve notice that no strong European power, and especially not Germany, should be allowed to gain a foothold." End quote.
I mean, in a,
foreshadowing.
Like, I mean, we're not like unaware of like the fact that America like brutalized whole nations of people to gain our land, right? Yeah. But like that being said, we have two coasts that are on two separate oceans that are very hard to get to each other. It's actually a unique naval situation, because like let's say Germany builds 12 battleships. Those 12 battleships have to cover how much coast? Like, enough that no one's getting through.
12
yeah.
miles.
Yeah, yeah, it's not long, yeah, right? Even England, it's like, all right, say your fleet is in the Atlantic. It's not going to take them that long to get, like, between you and France or to get, yes. you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas the U.S., it's like, we have to have two fleets. Don't have a choice.
The only country that has this even remotely similar problem is Russia.
Yeah.
But who's coming in from the Pacific side, though?
Japan?
At that time?
That was during the Meiji Restoration, if yeah. I remember correctly. So, Japan was starting to fucking right, really pump up.
Yeah.
Did they beat it?
They beat the Russians?
Not yet, but they're about to, okay. right?
And, I think they had beaten the Koreans.
Yeah, and China. They'd beaten China in 1895.
Oh, yeah, and that was a big shock, too, because everyone's like, China's...
Been around
a billion. Yeah, like, China's a billion, and Japan is not a billion.
So Roosevelt thoroughly enjoyed the Navy Department, not only because of his aforementioned fascination with sea power, but because the secretary, John Davis Long, took the whole summer off, making Roosevelt the acting secretary during those 3 months. Right?
So, he made the most of that.
He did.
He definitely did.
Thus, the nickname, the Hot Weather Secretary. His nickname was that because most of the cabinet would go
it's
home.
It's like
for
Hot
summer.
Girl Summer.
But for naval power.
The latest like, meme.
You know what? I don't actually mind that comparison that much. That's a pretty good comparison of me as a naval power.
Ben Shapiro?
That was a good Ben Shapiro, wasn't it?
So
I will say, though, Roosevelt got a lot of things wet. Ben Shapiro has gotten very few things wet. I'm just going to go ahead and put that out there. Come at me, Ben Shapiro, you fuck. I'll fight you. I don't care.
Roosevelt would fight you as well.
It definitely won't be a setup where you like show up to have a fair fight and then we all just jump you. Just kidding, Ben Shapiro. It'll be fair.
So John Davis.
I'll bring a knife.
So John Davis Long graduated from Harvard just before Roosevelt was born. So he's about 20 years older than Roosevelt. He served in the nothing job of the Massachusetts militia during the Civil War. So like didn't fight in the war.
like in case they get to Massachusetts.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, they're in Pennsylvania. I'm starting to get nervous.
He was a career...
300 miles away.
He was a career Republican politician who believed in temperance, reform within the machinery of political parties, and gradualism in everything else. He was round with sunken eyes, a soft chin, and a bushy mustache. He and Roosevelt would grow to hate each other. As Long put it, Roosevelt was, quote, a bull in a china shop, end quote. So Roosevelt took as his portfolio, and I want you to keep track of these things that Roosevelt's like, these are the things that he's like, Secretary Long.
Roosevelt's like, well, you're a pussy in a gun store. How dare you? Also, you're getting really into their like physical looks on this.
So
do you want us to picture them?
I do. Kind of. It's also.
I do.
You do? You picture?
I want to fantasize.
Lex can picture anyone with a mustache. He's like all the different types of mustaches and the styles.
No, it's also like one of my favorite historians is Barbara Tuchman, and she has that way of describing people. Like if you read the book The Guns of August, she's constantly trying to describe to you who these people, what they look like.
Because they all look real stupid. They do look also little... too. You know, it was like World War One, so it's like, well, he had three beards, kind of layered on each other. It was like a beard burrito. It's very difficult.
Except for the Russians, where it was matryoshka dolls of beards, nesting dolls.
Oh beards. Yeah, you take one beard off, and there's a bigger one under it. You're like, what kind of magic is this?
So Roosevelt takes as his portfolio. So I want you to think about these are the jobs that Roosevelt is like, hey, Secretary Long. You don't need to worry about this. I've got this for the Navy Department. Engineering for steam, science of hydrology and astronomy, naval law, diplomacy, finance, strategy and education, relations with Congress, the president, and press. Furthermore, he looked into promotions, lobbying for merit rather than seniority, and advocated giving engineers equal rank to line officers. So one wonders what was left for Secretary Long to actually do on a day-to-day basis if Roosevelt is doing all of those things.
I think I'll go summer in the Mediterranean now. We'll be off there.
Though Secretary Long probably had one really important thing to do, which was read the long CYA letters from Roosevelt explaining everything in his rambunctious assistant was doing.
I could see why Roosevelt would be annoying. Like, that's definitely like overachiever.
Yeah, Roosevelt would write these very long letters being like, this is exactly what I've done, so don't say when you come back I didn't tell you what I was doing because I sent it in that letter, and he would write these letters basically every day. Like, summary.
Did Roosevelt not know how to vacation? He was
He was terrible at it. Well, he did vacation, but his idea of a vacation was go to a place, do all of the things, climb all of the mountains that were there, maybe shoot all of the animals if they existed.
He had to do the best.
Yeah.
He had to have the best vacation out of anyone else.
It's that cartoon of like the type B, type A person. Yeah. The type B person goes, hey, why don't you smell the roses? And the type A person grabs all of the roses, goes, and then he holds up a trophy best at smelling roses.
He loved his ribbons and trophies.
You sort of missed the point, actually.
Yeah. His merit badges.
Theodore did occasionally leave the capital, but only so he could inspect dockyards or warships. By the end of his summer of de facto control of the Naval Department, he had requested from Congress 6 new modern battleships, 6 heavy cruisers, 75 torpedo boats, new dockyards, and a modernization program for existing ships, which included heavier armor, bigger guns, and smokeless powder. Politics.
All of those things are really good things to have.
Oh, absolutely. Roosevelt's not stupid.
Yeah. Smokeless powder?
Yeah, like, because this is right at the point where smokeless powder is being introduced.
Okay. I thought it was way after, and I was going to be like, yeah, no, that's a big deal.
No, this is cutting edge stuff. Okay. Smokeless powder is cutting edge in 1897. But politics, again, conspired against his efforts. What he got was one battleship and a handful of smaller ships. Neither Republicans nor Democrats in September of 1897 wanted to spend that kind of money on the Navy. Mm. That would not last long. So on October 27th, 1492, Christopher Columbus claimed the island of Cuba for Spain.
Mm.
In 15...
Things went well, right?
In 15... yep, we're going to get to that. How well things went for Cuba.
Oh my God.
So through the 17th and 18th centuries, Cuba was fought over, but never seriously threatened as a Spanish possession. But then Napoleon happened. The 19th century was to be a century of rebellion, bloodshed, and anguish for the Cuban people. In 1844, another slave rebellion occurred, which was crushed and thousands were executed. Then in 1868, the 10 Years' War began. During that war, somewhere around 400,000 guerrillas and about 60,000 civilians were killed. Another rebellion occurred in 1879. This little war only lasted a year, but would still kill thousands. In 1895, just over 400 years after Columbus, a third uprising, the Cuban War for Independence, began. Mm. This war would kill approximately 300,000 civilians in 3 years.
Jeez.
Spain was responsible for the deaths of somewhere around 1 million Cubans in the 19th century.
Wow, really?
So while the yellow press in the United States did exaggerate the details of Spanish actions against the Cuban people, it should not be thought that they were invented out of whole cloth.
Yeah. We're not innocent.
It's one of those things where, like, same with World War One. I know you've talked about this, about the Germans going through Belgium, there was a lot of, like, crazy journalistic stories about the Germans putting, like, babies' heads on pikes or whatever.
But they did murder a lot of people.
Yeah, but they didn't shoot them in the fucking head. Right. So it's like, what's really like, you know.
But is it like that meme with the Spider-Man?
Yeah.
Like,
Spider-Man? I'm sure we'll get into this, but no, I mean, any, especially in our quote unquote, what do they call it, geopolitically, zone of influence?
Yeah, or sphere of influence.
Sphere of influence, thank you. America always has, and Dan Carlin did a great episode on this, but America always has this weird problem where we're like, it's in our sphere of influence, but also it's an independence movement for freedom?
Yeah, I know. It is always like, a little difficult.
I mean, since World War II. After World War II, we stopped giving a shit about that. Yeah,
that's 100%. True. Yeah. So in January 1898, fearing for American citizens and their property in Havana, President McKinley ordered the battleship...
Emphasis on property.
Yes. I mean, like, I mean, yeah.
So if you pronounce that wrong, it's property. I'm a property. So I have a property in Cuba. Is that a person? It's property. How dare you call a person that isn't a person property. All right, I might cut
so
that off.
Ordered, so McKinley orders the USS Maine to that port. He orders it to Havana. Mm. She arrived on January 25th. On the night of February 15th, 1898, something went wrong aboard the Maine.
Oh no.
To this day, we're not entirely sure.
Was it AIDS?
No.
Sorry. Sorry, I'm a little off the mark historically. I'm sorry.
But most likely, the improper storage of gunpowder and or coal, coupled with the newly installed electrical systems aboard the ship,
with agent provocateurs,
caused a massive explosion.
Okay.
Do you know how shitty the first electrical systems were?
Yeah.
Think about like the first anything on the internet. It's like true, the first, yeah. like the first social media, you know, AOL.
Yeah.
It was that. But for electricity going through the walls of a thing.
Which are made of metal next to coal dust and gunpowder.
Yeah. They didn't have electrical tape yet. They had electricity, but not electrical tape. It was a whole thing.
So Maine had arrived with a crew of 26 officers, 290 sailors, and 39 Marines, 355 souls in all. In a matter of seconds, 261 of them, or 75% of the crew, died. Due to the construction delays, Maine had been obsolete before she had been launched. She because of like political wrangling and budget problems, her design by the time she is actually launched was obsolete.
They sent over damaged goods?
Not damaged goods. Just she was a ship.
Ticking time bomb.
No, no. It was more along the lines of like if she had gone up in a straight up fight against a modern ship, she was obsolete. Like her guns weren't large enough, her armor wasn't thick enough, she wasn't fast enough. If she'd been built on time, she would have been state of the art. But because of delays, she was built like 5 years late, and so Britain had already been like,
right,
cute.
No.
So
we used all of the stuff we got from India to make this other ship. That's way better, you stupid Yankee.
But it was a devastating blow nonetheless. Roosevelt decided that Spain was responsible.
Well, you know the other thing, too, if there was a bunch of delays, and this wouldn't surprise me at all, because this happens with like houses, right? If there's a bunch of delays, there's a reason weather, like anti-weather stuff on a house is like just under the siding and the siding is like part of the roof. All of that stuff is like meant to protect the wood from the weather. And when you have these delays in construction projects, that just means it sits there
in the weather
the whole time, right? So it could have literally just been like some fucking pole had rusted that they didn't realize rusted, and so like a wire got through it on their fucking weird ass like electrical system that probably looked like Doc Brown's lab or whatever.
I try to imagine if that happened during the social media age, there'd be at least like 15 different conspiracy theories.
We only need the one. So Roosevelt decides that Spain is responsible. He said, quote, Mr. Alger, who is a naval officer, this is to tell you who Mr. Alger was, a naval officer and an expert on explosives, Mr. Alger cannot possibly know anything about the accident. All the best men in the department agree that whether probable or not, it is certainly possible that the ship was blown up by a mine, end quote, and that mine would have to be provided by Spain. So Roosevelt bastards. Immediately...
Because who else can actually make mines?
Well, and who else would want to blow up the Maine? Would be his... He couldn't think of anybody else who would want anything to do with blowing up the Maine except Spain.
Right, because right? The British wouldn't just gain from an American-Spanish...
He couldn't think of that.
I feel like he could, but he just strategically didn't blinders. Bring it up.
So Roosevelt immediately asked for a new battleship to replace the Maine. He's like, we have to build a new one. As well as drawing up plans for the redeployment of the fleet. So he's already drawing up plans to move ships around because he's like, this might cause a war. This was necessary because Spain had an 8-6 advantage, or that if we do stupid math, a 4-3 advantage in capital ships. So Spain's navy is larger than America's in 1898. However, McKinley, who had fought at Antietam in the American Civil War and stated, quote, I've seen the bodies stacked like cordwood and I don't want to go through that sort of thing again, end quote, which is maybe like one of the most sobering lines anyone's ever used to describe war. I've seen the men stacked up like cordwood. McKinley resolutely attempted to avoid the war with Spain, and he opened up negotiations. He's like, okay, one of our battleships exploded in Havana. We're going to try to figure out what's going on.
You understand how that might be a problem
exactly.
For us.
So let's talk this through. Now, Roosevelt thought this was the greatest nonsense. He's like, this is nonsense. Don't negotiate with Spain. America had a new...
So he was gung-ho.
Oh, absolutely. Way. America might have a smaller fleet, but it was a modern fleet. Like, it had been built much more recently. The Spanish fleet isn't, like, made of wood.
Sexy.
It's not made of wood, but it's not as new. The American fleet is a lot newer.
It's classical.
Yeah.
His own fleet classical that we have here. Let's spend Cuba. Don't worry about the Cuba. Cuba's like a little side girl, you know? It's like a little something you have on when you go away. All right.
Okay. So he believed, Roosevelt believed that fighting Spain was in the nation's interest. Control of Cuba, the Philippines, and other Spanish colonies would provide a buffer against Japan or any other European nation. He did sympathize with the Cuban revolutionaries on humanitarian grounds, stating, quote, I would regard a war with Spain on the grounds of humanity and self-interest.
Roosevelt said this.
Yeah, Roosevelt said this. He's like, you know, he sympathizes with the Cuban revolutionaries, but to Kunin's point earlier, it like having to balance that against national interest is going to be difficult for him.
He's thinking about both. Land.
Yeah, but he's not able to read what Spain is doing in Cuba and just sort of accept that as being okay, right? Like, but at the same token, he absolutely wants to be like, Cuba might be independent, but like, we get naval bases, right? And like, you're not going to have any other friends but the United States, right?
Well, at the time too, you had the coaling station problem
exactly,
and naval issues where it's like, imagine it's like every ocean is the Arizona desert, right? And you like stop at a gas station and it says no gas station for 217 miles or whatever.
Yeah.
That was essentially coaling stations for ships. You needed to make sure you had enough of them in the right places that you wouldn't just strand ships in the middle of fucking
when war. This is actually the problem Russia has when it fights Japan is the Japanese destroy the Russian fleet at Port Arthur in what is now I suppose China destroys the Russian Pacific fleet. So the Russians send the Baltic fleet from St. Petersburg. Well, Japan had just signed its alliance with Britain, so Britain goes, you can't use the Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you can't use any of our coaling stations. You cannot get coal from any British.
I understand that this might be inconvenient for you because of how much land we own in Africa.
Yeah, especially
and you might
on
have to go
coast.
Around Africa to get there.
Basically, they get the long, long way.
You had to go they had to go the long way, and they had to because they didn't have enough coaling stations. They had to stock up on so much coal that when they fight the Battle of Tsushima, part of the reason it's not the only reason, but part of the reason the Japanese win is every Russian ship is covered in coal dust, meaning that any shell that hits them just starts a firestorm on the ship. It's not the and the other part of it is the
unlike
ships
today's
are,
Russian Navy where all the ships are covered in angel dust
and radioactivity.
Also that. But and hey, they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah,
that's true. You have radioactive angel dust.
One leads to the other. The being covered in angel dust is why they're anyway. So
that's pretty good.
And that but Roosevelt goes that it would be good to accomplish, quote, the complete freeing of America from European dominion while giving the American people something to think about which isn't material gain, end quote. So he's like, hey, this will
there's
give us
no material gain involved in getting colonies.
So for the vast majority of Americans, no, right? Like for Dole Fruit Company, sure. There's gain to be had.
So much gain. I will say too, it's the classic jingoist thing, and it's funny because you have like,
but it's noble. It's noble.
Well,
it's a noble venture.
There's an interesting. There was a different podcast I listened to. I think it was Dan Carlin as well, but he was talking about Japan before World War II and how like the emperor was technically in charge, but you still had I believe it was called the Diet, which was
Parliament
parliament sort of or whatever. But you had these huge chunks of Japanese society that fucking hated democracy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they hated democracy because it did the exact thing that our democracy is doing right now. It's putting party over country, mm-hmm. right? It's like thinking like, no, we're going to hate other Japanese people mm-hmm. more than we hate the actual enemies of Japan, mm-hmm. right? Because we have this like party system. And you know how politics is. It's like the whole... You know, you don't want to see how the sausage is made. You don't want to go into like a committee meeting in Congress. Like, because it's dirty. It's like dirty and it's very, all the like scratch your back, scratch mind shit. And it's that by itself just isn't like really an honorable pursuit. I mean, the Romans had the same problem with like politics. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, was kind of looked down on for getting into politics.
Exactly,
because he was from a class that was supposed to be above those things.
Yeah, and not part of the governing class.
And I think that jingoism is very similar to what was happening in Japan and other societies, where it's just like, no, like this democracy, this constant like fucking horse race bean counting that we have to do every year, it cheapens us. Like, it cheapens us as a nation, right? Yeah.
And so
it's not 100% wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not, you know,
it's one of the many ways in which Franklin Roosevelt is the better version of his cousin. Like Franklin Roosevelt takes just a lot of the things Teddy Roosevelt thought and believed about a whole bunch of things and goes, but let's not make it quite as terrible, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Franklin Roosevelt is very much an internationalist. We have to be involved in the rest of the world, but we're not going to be imperialist, right? Like, he institutes the Good Neighbor Policy. Yeah. He makes it very clear to Britain and France that the end of the war will mean the end of your colonial empires.
But what about the Philippines? We're not going to talk about the Philippines.
But even there, he's the one who signs the act that grants the Philippines its independence in 1946. Like, the Philippines...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I am very much of the opinion that if FDR had lived, France wouldn't have been able to fight the war in Indochina. Mm. That Roosevelt would have been like, no, this is nonsense.
Force him to give it up.
Yeah, like, this is not part of... This is not part of what we're doing.
He did have the track record of that.
Yeah. And you know, so this is one of those places where, but Roosevelt also is, Franklin Roosevelt is also of that opinion. Like, the mere making of money is not a good enough thing. A country needs more than that to be, but he also didn't think that war was necessarily the way to do that. It would be things like, that's part of the New Deal, part of like public works.
Service,
service, like this idea of, okay.
Sacrifice.
Yeah, you know, of you know, and the idea that we're in this together kind of thing. So as war became more and more certain in the late winter and early spring of 1898, Roosevelt sent his last cable as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, dated February 25th, 1898. It was sent to Commodore Dewey, the commander of the Asiatic Squadron based then in Hong Kong. Quote, Dewey, Hong Kong, order the squadron, except for the Monocacy, to Hong Kong, keep full of coal in event of declaration of war against
Spain. U.S. was docking at Hong Kong, I think?
Yeah, like, we had an agreement with the British to be able to dock there, probably.
America and the British have been docking for a while.
We talked about that with John Paul Jones.
A little callback right there.
It's just, it was a lot more consensual in 1898.
It was a very beautiful moment.
Less gunpowder.
This time we're going to dock.
Without
gunpowder. We're going to dock on a bed of roses. It's going to be romantic.
So keep full of coal in event of declaration of war against Spain. Our duty will be to see that the Spanish squadron does not leave the Asiatic coast, and then offensive operations in the Philippines. Keep Olympia, that's his flagship, until further orders, end quote. He had taken this action without consulting either Secretary Long or President McKinley. So, on April 19th, 1898, exactly 1 year to the day after Roosevelt had been sworn in, McKinley asked for a declaration of war. His attempts to negotiate a truce between the Spanish government and the Cuban rebels had been rebuffed. That same day, Congress passed a resolution supporting Cuban independence and authorized the president to use military force to achieve that end.
They were actually going to make a deal. They were really close. But the Spanish representatives kept saying Barcelona, and we're like, "That's what a bunch of fucking assholes." You know what I mean, guys? Jesus Christ!
And this resolution supporting Cuban independence included what is called the Teller Amendment, which stated the United States would not annex Cuba following any conflict with Spain. Mm. So it is in U.S. law that we are not allowed to annex Cuba. The amendment...
Mainly because they were brown people. They didn't want
that's
to have...
part of it. That is absolutely... The other part of it was to protect... The other part of it, though... So that is... Racism played a part of it, and economics played a part, which is that the guy who... Teller, I think... represented people who had a lot of interests in sugar in the United States. So if Cuba was in the part, if
it, with their
it didn't want to compete with the domestic sugar.
No, that's happened in a bunch of countries during this period where they're like, we would love to make them full citizens, but then they would vote.
Yeah.
And they don't look like us. It's really, I mean, would you let people who vote who didn't look like you? I don't think you would.
So on April 21st, Spain severed diplomatic relations with the United States. A few hours later, the president ordered the United States Navy to blockade Cuba. 2 days later, in response to the blockade, Spain declared war on the United States. The United States Navy, in large measure due to TR, was ready for it. Mm. So what did we learn? It is interesting to see how a small group of people, Roosevelt, Mahan, Cabot Lodge, can take advantage of events to radically change American policy. Most Americans would have opposed a war with Spain in 1897.
Hmm.
And yet, by the time war was declared, Americans were overwhelmingly in favor of the war.
We hate war until we declare it. Then we're like, fuck you!
Was
you made us declare war! You made us do this, all right? So you're going to...
Well, wasn't it also because of the newspapers themselves?
Yeah,
the
media
coverage.
Exactly,
the
media coverage. But the other part of it to think about, I think, is that... I think it would be interesting to like have a time machine and go back in time, because the yellow press, right, as it got called,
derided,
was so omnipresent. You almost get the feeling that maybe Americans by 1898 have become immune to it. Because like
we're immune to Babylon Bee or whatever.
Yeah, everything was so over the top all the time. I mean, and you also have to remember that newspapers come out like 3 times a day.
Oh,
right. Like there's the morning edition, the mid afternoon edition, the evening edition. So every single headline that you see multiple times a day is just outrageous.
Trans
nonsense.
People destroying your democracy. Was it like that?
More or less. Yeah. But it'd be like, Spain butchered 500 babies last night, and then it was new evidence. You'll never guess the new evidence that makes Spain complicit in blowing up the Maine. And
well, and there was a lot of political fighting within the newspaper industry at the time. Yeah. I remember I read a book called "There's Power in a Union" a long time ago, so I might be getting this wrong, but that lead up, like the Gilded Age, essentially was like basically the birthing of Americans. Like union movements.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you could obviously you can trace it back to like pre-Civil War and certain things.
But you definitely have like the Second Industrial Revolution is
labor
what
movement.
Which makes unions.
And it wasn't just that, but it was also there was a huge influx of like Southern and Eastern Europeans who had much longer memories of like worker solidarity. Mm-hmm. And so many of the newspapers you would see on the street would be like, the Bricklayers Union Times or whatever, everything had this political bent. And so they start kind of like trying to over publicize each other and be like, nah, the capitalists are evil. Man. No, the bomb throwing anarchists
with the big beard.
Distraction. But because the other side keeps upping the rhetoric, you have to up the rhetoric, and it just, it's just a product.
So it's just a lot of shrill voices.
It almost certainly contributes. The question that is interesting is how much did people take that on board when you consider the fact that, like, for instance, there's, I forget who it is. There's someone around McKinley whose diary was found, someone who's in the State Department, and their diary is very much like, we're definitely not going to go to war through most of this until it happens, right? Like, this is a person who is in office going, well, the newspapers are...
Dear diary, well, fuck me.
Whoops, wrong about that one.
I lost a bet today, dear diary, for a lot of money and also...
So you're saying that basically the Spanish-American War was very elite-driven? Like,
I think in large measure,
I mean, as usual.
Yeah, but I mean, it unlike for instance
the Civil War.
Well, take, for instance, the difference between the Spanish-American War and the wars that are, the two wars that are that are in reality closer to it are World War I and World War II, when you actually like map it out on a timeline.
Yeah.
World War I is like Woodrow Wilson bends over backwards to not go into that war, and it is it is Germany's fault that we end up in that war. Like
the what?
The United States.
Come on. Everybody's always mad at Germany. And then, like, they're just starting shit all over the place.
And World War II, what's interesting there is that Franklin Roosevelt is absolutely attempting to maneuver the United States into the war, but not against Japan, right? Like, he is going out of his way to get Germany to do something that will bring us into the war in Europe. Like, he is going, hey, we will sink German submarines if they're within 100 miles of the American coast. And that's like, and we'll, you know, the Lend-Lease Act is like, we are going to bankroll, we are going to bankroll Britain and then the Soviet Union for as long as it takes to beat you.
And if you've ever seen the 90s movie Blank Check, where the kid just gets to write $1 million check from the mob to himself, that was essentially what the Soviet Union and Britain got to do. So how much money did we take from you? How many radios?
All of them.
We get all the radios, guys. They have this thing, spam. I guess they have spam. It's like
never
meat,
had
sort
radios
of.
Before. So.
They had radios.
There were three of them.
Also, whatever. I'm not going to go down this road.
And what else did we learn? Kuna, what's your lesson?
I actually have a good lesson learned for this one. I was thinking about it just before. Mm-hmm. Fucking better to ask for forgiveness than permission, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's basically the story of Roosevelt's,
as
like,
assistant secretary. Yeah. Like,
absolutely. Ooh, so I went, like, accidentally asked Congress for, like, 12 battleships. Do you know how fucking embarrassing that was for me? I mean, they gave us a battleship and a couple other cruisers, but God damn it, Roosevelt. Sorry. I'm so sorry.
I've got
a battleship.
I've also moved the entire Navy to a war footing. Just thought you should know.
Yeah, I thought, like, a war footing would be good. Ooh, was that not? Mm.
It's too late. They already moved.
Yeah. Sorry you missed that memo because you were doing something somewhere? I don't know.
Were you too busy reading the last four memos I sent you that were all 20 pages long? So what's your lesson?
My lesson is don't trust a guy who wears a cape.
God damn it.
I feel like he would have popped out of the main, like, remember the main?
I definitely didn't stop this. Oops. Accidentally blew up one of my own battleships to stop this war. I hope I don't have to charge on a hill.
I sunk my battleship. All right. That's our show. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow us on Instagram, laughing hist. Mm-hmm. Ask questions, leave a comment, leave feedback, validate Dr. History Scholar's ego.
I would like to say that I don't need that, but I would really like to.
Yeah, no, he
needs it.
I could really use it right now. Definitely rate us. Rate us. Give us 5 stars. If you want to give us less than that, go fuck yourself instead.
Just don't do it.
None of that one star bullshit. I don't. Yeah. I will find you.
Will. I don't think we can threaten people. I don't think we can legally threaten people over the air.
Paul? Zach?
Just start Brendan, Braylon, Joseph. Just white names. Just people.
Chad with two D's.
There's a Wrangler and a Levi out there that are fucking...
All right. That's been our show, Laughing Historically. Thank you so much.
That's our show.